Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here with you this evening. This is my first visit to the University of Illinois. I arrived at 2:30 yesterday afternoon, and I have learned a great deal since I have been here. Among the things that I have learned, which no doubt you already know, number one, there are some of whom some 1,200 are black. I've also learned that of some 5,000 faculty, about 25 are black. And I went in search of the Black Studies program at the University of Illinois, which I normally do when I visit college and university campuses. And I have not yet been able to find the Black Studies program at the University of Illinois for whatever that's worth. And I think it's worth a good deal. So I have learned something about your campus, and I can't help but wonder what all of this means. So much for my preface. My subject for tonight is Liberation Directions for the 70s. We have somehow managed to come through one of the most extraordinary decades of all times. The 60s were years marked by momentous events, by startling developments, by enormously significant shifts in human behavior. Not the least of these was the breaking of chains which have bound black students through the centuries. If the 60s can be called anything, they can certainly be called the decade of the black student rebellion. It began even before four young students at A&T College in Greensboro, North Carolina, decided that if they could buy toothpaste in a 5- and 10-cent store, then they could buy a hamburger also. So they walked to the lunch counter and sat down. And they sat, and they sat, and they sat. This was, without a doubt, the most historic sitting known to man. From that incident was born the massive student sit-in movement, which revolutionized the civil rights movement, galvanized thousands who had never before been involved, and anesthetized, at least for a time, the nation's nerve center of racism. The past several years evoke extraordinary memories as black students grabbed America by its neck and sought to choke some decency into its soul. You remember how James Meredith took on the University of Mississippi and later started his walk against fear across that deep South state. You recall how, when he was shot down, supporters rushed to complete what James Meredith had started. You know how black students brought a gasp of alarm from America when they marched out of a seized Cornell University building with weapons and bandoliers as both badges of courage and symbols of the depths to which the fight against racism had sunk. Black students across the land took over many buildings, held administrators captive, and resorted to other extreme measures to remind those who dwell in the bastions of power that they had all these long years refused to read the writing on the wall. Black high school students refused to pay homage any longer to the whites who were their teachers and their principals, and who had duped them into believing that black was evil and white was right. These high school students led the clamor for community control of schools, time after time ousted many white principals and white teachers who practiced racism instead of teaching. Universities rushed to meet black student demands for black studies, black cultural centers, and other avenues through which black students could seek and find for themselves the pride and awareness of self, which are essential to the ultimate liberation for which we all struggle. But black studies fell under the control of whites, and as yet, has to come to be the liberating influence that it could be. The 60s were years of battle and years of tears, years of decision and years of indecision. They were years in which blacks took uncertain but unfaltering steps into the jaws of hell. And they were years which brought all of America to the final realization that black America means business. Great strides were taken, many mistakes were made, much blood was shed. But more than anything else, blacks in America proved beyond any doubt that they were on their way. And out in the front, helping to lead the way, was the black student. But now the 60s have passed, and we are well into a new decade of decision. And what was good for the 10 years just past may not, will not always be good for the years ahead. It is vital, then, that all of us pause to review the past and draw from it all that will help in the future. Let us then chart the new paths which must be taken by the black leaders of the 70s, the young, vigorous, bold, intelligent blacks who must make the 70s the decade of the ultimate victory. But first, let's look at the events of our history which are highlighted by the contributions made by other black men who either assumed or had the role of leadership thrust upon them. In the context of historical data and with reference to the decade ahead, we can see the shadows and hear the echoes of black leaders, ranging from the debates of January 1832 that followed the hanging of the black insurrectionist Nat Turner, to the brutal killing of young Black Panther leader Fred Hampton on December 4th, 1969. The revolts led by 31-year-old Nat Turner became the pivotal point in the political climate of the state of Virginia and other states that finally led to a semblance of abolition of chattel slavery. Following the armed revolt, countless slaveholders began to look upon slavery as the greatest evil which could befall them. The masters were not only physically afraid, but they were afraid of their own political process, which could permit certain states to become swamped with even more slaves than the already existing imbalance of slave population in proportion to the population of slave owners. In some states, this imbalance was 3 to 4 slaves for every white person. In 1832, the colonization laws which would send blacks to Africa were defeated in Congress, 2 months after Nat Turner died in the city of Jerusalem in Southampton County, Virginia. And the seeds were sown that gave rise to other slave revolts and led to the economic panic of 1837 and the so-called Emancipation Proclamation of 1865. From Turner to Hampton, there was a procession of able black leaders who gave cause and purpose and life to the development of our inherited struggle for liberation. There was Frederick Douglass, noted abolitionist, who was born in February 1817. Douglass, editor of his own weekly newspaper, the North Star, lectured and wrote for the end of the evils of slavery. Once asked the question, "What to the American slave is your 4th of July?" Frederick Douglass replied, "I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim." And Douglass also said, "Without struggle, there is no freedom." And then there was W.E.B. Du Bois, born in February 1868. Du Bois was a historian, a sociologist, a teacher, an editor, and a writer. And through his writings and his persuasive magic with words, he was most instrumental in leading and influencing men. On January 31, 1906, Du Bois invited a select group of men to meet him in Ontario, Canada, for aggressive action on the part of men who believe in Negro freedom and growth. This act, the Niagara Movement, led to his involvement in the conferences wherein the NAACP was officially organized. Du Bois participated in the first Pan-African Conference. He organized the Congress of Races, organized a group in Geneva to keep the rights of Africans before the League of Nations, and created what had never existed before, a Negro intelligentsia. At the 1897 meeting of the American Negro Academy, Du Bois said, and I bid you listen well, "The greatness of peoples springs from their ability to grasp the grand concept of being. It is the absorption of a people, a nation, of a race, which lifts them up to the skies. But until these gifts of a lofty civilization are secured, men are sure to remain low and debased. Who are the agents to lift up this people of ours to a grand plane? Who are to bring them up to the height of noble thought, grand civility, a chaste and elevating culture, refinement, and the impulses of irrepressible progress? It is done," he said, "by the scholars and the thinkers who have secured the vision which penetrates the center of nature and sweeps the circles of historic enlightenment, and who have the insight into the life of things and learn the art by which men touch the springs of action." Du Bois is still talking. "For to transform and stimulate the souls of a race or a people is the work of intelligence. It is a work which demands the clear induction of worldwide facts and the perception of their application to new circumstances. It is work which will require the most skillful resources and the use of the scientific spirit. The leader, the creative and organizing mind, is the master need in all societies. But if they are not inspired with the notion of duty, then with all their Latin and Greek and science, they are but pedants and opportunists. These leaders must not be mere scholars. They must be both scholars and philanthropists, for thus it has been in all the history of man." I'm still quoting Du Bois. "In all the great revolutions and in all the great reforms which have transpired, scholars have been conspicuous in the reconstruction of society, in formulating laws, in producing great emancipations, in the revival of letters, in the advancement of science, in the renaissance of art, in the destruction of gross superstitions, and in the restoration of true and enlightened religion. And what is the spirit with which they are to come to this work? Whether rivalries and dissensions may divide man in the social and political world, let generosity govern us. Let us emulate one another in the prompt recognition of rare genius or uncommon talent from whatever source. It is only thus that we can bring forth, stimulate, and uplift all the latent genius garnered up in the byplaces and sequestered corners of this neglected race. It is only thus we can nullify and break down the conspiracy which would forever limit and narrow the range of Negro talent in this caste-tainted country. It is only thus we can secure that recognition which is the rightful prerogative of every race of man." W.E.B.
Dubois.
Then there was the gallant young African leader, Patrice Lumumba, who died as a political prisoner in February 1961, a victim of the terrible intrigue of imperialistic politics surrounding his native land of the Congo. And then there was Martin Luther King, Jr., who was born on January 15, 1929, and whose preachments on moral persuasion and nonviolent resistance spearheaded the civil rights movement, which spanned almost two decades, arousing people to move in one direction or the other. From the incident of Rosa Parks on a bus in Birmingham, Alabama, to that fateful afternoon on a balcony in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. King pursued the path and subscribed to the vision that the awakened conscience of America and the world would bring an end to social injustice. It did not. There was Malcolm X, who was assassinated on February 21, 1965, in the Audubon Theater in New York. Malcolm's life began in abject poverty. It ended in martyred symbolism, such as had not been imagined by the initiators of the acts that led to his death. Malcolm came from the grassroots. He was identified with and recognized as a leader and spokesman for the grassroots. His beliefs, his principles, his messages seeped into every sector of this country, and they were recognized by political enclaves in many parts of the world. Malcolm indicted and accused, inflamed, exhorted, inspired, and cast an almost hypnotic spell upon the hearts and minds of an oppressed, suppressed, and repressed black people. His greatest message was the will to attain freedom by any means necessary. Malcolm X's leadership was best characterized by his intense desire to develop a powerful revolutionary force within black communities. The actual organizing of cadres, which would have spiraling effects or levels of leadership that would reach into every sphere of black community life, and then into the structures that enslave the lives of black people. This idea, plus his intent to internationalize the struggle of black people in America, led to his demise. Malcolm's words, which were like a whiplash to the racist minds of this country, afforded a new sense of dignity and fearlessness to black men, and a new sense of strength and protection to black women. His sense of timing, his accurate accounting of the atrocities and the sickness of white American thought, began to roll away the veils of doubt and uncertainty for black people. He stood in the face of the enemy and never flinched, never wavered in the task he had set before himself, to move his people to a position where they could hear the tunes of a new drummer. In Brother Malcolm's words, "No one will give you power. You must prepare to move to a position where you will take control of your own lives. We must teach our story, but first we must know our story. And then we must take it everywhere. Tell it on the corners, in the taverns, in the churches, in the schools, in the courts of the world. We must not be satisfied. We must not be placated. We must not rest until we have total power, until we are indeed liberated." Malcolm's legacy to black men can be seen in the cries and the banners and the slogans and the pride of black people seeking empowerment. And then there was Fred Hampton, the young man from Maywood, Illinois, who heard the voices and the echoes of all the great leaders who had come before him, and who responded out of an awareness and a belief in what they had transmitted. Fred Hampton, slain black leader of the Black Panther Party of Illinois, was born in 1948, the same year that brought into being the first convening of the General Assembly of the United Nations. At the age of 21, excuse me, talking all day. At the age of 21, Fred Hampton was buried in a wasted countryside in Haynesville, Louisiana, the victim of a national conspiracy to wipe out the Black Panther Party, and perhaps a trial run for the subtle and hideous but increasingly visible attempts to commit genocide against black people in general. Fred epitomized the growing consensus among black youths that they must disdain middle-class materialistic goals, that they must heighten the conflict between the systems, the power wielders of these systems, the corporate structures of white power on one side and oppressed peoples of this country, regardless of color, on the other side. For in the political platform of the Black Panther Party, white America saw the very enactments of the teachings and the acts of all other black leaders and the implementation of these teachings into social practice. What white America saw was the rebellion of Nat Turner, the intelligence of Du Bois, the advice to struggle for freedom from Douglass, the arousing of the people from Dr. King, the closing of the chain that linked to Lumumba, and the powerful voice of Malcolm X urging on a people to make the necessary allies and acquire the necessary techniques for control. The Black Revolution, through an orderly procession of leaders who stood at the helm during various levels or stages of the struggle for liberation, this black revolution found its way through the chambers of fear and uncertainty to the threshold of actual realization that black people must not only acquire power, but maintain power. I recall the plaintive words of Fred Hampton, who said one day, "I often wonder what I would be doing with my life if I had been born free. I often wonder what I would be doing with my life if I had been born free." We can grasp the pathos of that youthful party and all other black youths who shrug and push away the dreadfulness of their mission and proclaim for all the world to hear, "You can kill the revolutionary," they say, "but you cannot kill the revolution." So if Turner has been given the credit of heralding in the age of revolt, and all other leaders who followed in his wake can be considered as sires of each successive group of leaders, then you here tonight, you black brothers and sisters, are the heirs apparent to the grand and glorious fortune that has been handed down from across the centuries and from the immediate pressures of the 60s. The decade of 1970 requires the understanding that a new generation of leadership has come into being. This new leadership has its course already charted. A new quality has evolved from the lessons and the examples of the old order of leadership. This new quality speaks not to the use of the same language, not to the use of the former slogans of the past, but to a new form which will facilitate the transition from one level of struggle to the next highest step toward freedom. It will also incorporate the new concept that leadership must come from various segments and planes of black community life, and it will no longer embrace the thesis that leaders are expendable. From the theories of Malcolm X and others, that there should be levels of leadership so diffused as to accord to no particular individual and no special interest group, a multi-position platform from which to speak, deliberate, and act. And from the theories of Stokely Carmichael, that all hands and minds are needed on the liberation front, we can witness a more amorphous or hydra-like process for revolutionary procedure. This process spells the end to charismatic leadership that prevailed in the past. And it also spells the end of the crippling situation which allowed the white power structure and white accommodating Negroes to institute and recognize any one portion of the black community as a repository for all black thought and consensus. It spells out and ordains an end to the liquidation of talent and creative energy, which can be more useful in the tooling up for real development within black communities. This new awareness, which you must have, causes us to ask certain questions that are directed to the new roles of young black students who must meet the challenge of carving out a new pathway to liberation. And these are questions which you must constantly ask yourselves. Number one, how do you develop a strategy that will allow you to acquire the skills and techniques in all areas of service, study, research, and endeavor, and at the same time maintain and preserve the collective or unified cause of black people? In other words, what tactics will you employ to ensure that your energies and your skills will never become compromised or coerced into a position which is counter-revolutionary to the struggle of black people? Number two, how do you, from out of this strategy, investigate and explore all avenues and instances which will afford the greatest degree of credibility for your involvement with all aspects of power-directed activities, so that this involvement is in turn readily interpreted, readily made available, and offers the greatest measure of credibility to black communities affected by your interchange? Number three, how do you move in and out of the economic and political levels of white control structures and master the techniques that will make for the establishment of a black economic order within the economic order and a black political order within the political order? Let me repeat that one, because if you don't remember anything else, remember this one. How do you, black students, move in and out of the economic and political levels of white control structures? Master those techniques while you're moving in and out, and take those techniques back home for the establishment of a black economic order within the economic order and a black political order within the political order. Number four, what history and what research will you need in order to have the insight and the knowledge to differentiate all shifts and changes in an oppressive established order, so that black communities will not be exposed to suffering that comes from lack of awareness? I'll repeat that one. What history and what research will you need in order to have the insight and the knowledge to differentiate all shifts and changes in an oppressive established order so that black communities will not be exposed to suffering that comes from a lack of awareness? Number five, how do you link all areas of black community living to a common political base that is organized and geared to preserve and protect and to keep empowered the lifestyle and the platform of black people in black communities? Number six, how do you understand your new role so well that when you assist in the continuous and ever-present process of education which must go on in black communities, you do so with full acceptance that you are working yourself out of or teaching yourself out of business? For the role of the young black in the marketplace is to so instruct as to leave a stream of newly prepared persons in their wake. With this method of each one teach one, the knowledge and the revolution rolls on. This is one of the tools for development, and growth from this chain reaction is automatic. Number seven, what are the other tools needed for developing black communities? The tools of a self-educating process, the tools of active service and involvement, setting up of meaningful programs which evolve from interchange and interaction with indigenous residents about their own expressed needs. The tools of self-criticism, self-evaluation, self-correction, to prevent any tendencies from being too individualistic, too self-important, or too far removed from changing events to be receptive and amenable to change. In this instance, the question really is, how do you give of yourself in a manner and with the wisdom that your skills are but tools to be utilized and kept in service for all black people? Experts are but servants to and for the people. And finally, number eight, how do you establish and maintain the optimism which will serve as a guiding force for getting the job done? How does this optimism keep you refueled to know and abide with the principle that if another man stumbles or falls or is removed, you and many others must take his place? How do you keep this optimism regulated, realistic and relevant to any program, to the extent that you are never confronted with any instance which causes you to overlook the depths of this society's institutionalized pathology, racism? Young black students face a challenge of all times. It will not be easy to move within the framework of a system which programs black people out and yet become invisible, though visible, invisible enough to devise the strategy for the complete survival and liberation of all black people. I have said in a recent column that the most fundamental right for any human being is the right to develop to his fullest potential. In a country where a man is repressed and suppressed through cyclical and systematic processes, development and growth become phenomena that are doled out only as a means of accommodation for a few blacks, whereas the remainder live and die out their lives under the constant pall of oppression. The seriousness of this predicament makes it difficult to unharness the creative and spiritual energies of the larger portion of the residents of black communities. But it also causes us all to take this factor and use it as the incentive or the best organizing tool we have for action. It is clear that there's a dwindling need for labor in this country as it moves from the stages of one industrial revolution to the wings of a second revolution. It is not difficult to understand the demands of the power elite to invest astronomical sums in the technological advances of the future that have admittedly little room for supporting huge segments of the populace who are unable to compete in this new society. It should be clear to young black business aspirants that the capitalistic economy does not intend to promote small businesses to any appreciable degree, and that the national economy is moving rapidly toward an entirely monolithic entity of the state and its military-industrial combine. Recognizing this, the fraud of black capitalism becomes clear. Another factor not to be underestimated is that black communities, through the expertise of young people such as you, must be programmed, motivated, and activated to seek some solution to the obsolescence of jobs, housing, education, and even life itself. Well, in line with these glaring facts is the fact that people so oppressed are ever in a virtual state of eruption. For when they are consciously or unconsciously aware of a glaring difference in their lives, and this difference is linked to the hint of impending doom, they are then in a submerged but volatile state of revolt. The second industrial revolution is destroying the economic potential of black communities in particular and poor communities in general. Increasingly, formal schooling, not necessarily the ability to perform tasks, is the credential required for entry into the main economic system. And this schooling has become more and more a matter of high specialty and is being geared into more carefully circumscribed areas of technological advancement. New fields of education are coinciding with the needs and demands of this scientific development. Ecology, the science of behavior and environmental influence, is rapidly replacing other fields of the social sciences. Cybernetics, the science of computers, is replacing industrial arts and sciences, just to mention a few. So it is no wonder that black youths in high schools and colleges are in a constant state of unrest and upheaval. They recognize the fact that they are being programmed out of an educative process and into obsolescence. Can black students accept and meet this challenge? I say yes. They can meet it from out of a new sense of awareness and from out of the knowledge that once they have legitimized the struggle in the hearts of the masses of black people in black communities, they will have equipped themselves with the greatest weapon for the battle, which is in their hands. So you, my black brothers and sisters, you can go forth as one of the new young leaders, instructed and steeped in the knowledge of the legacy handed down to you by former leaders. Instill with the requirements of the manifest destiny of our lives to live as free men, and imbued with the know-how and the insight to continue to search for better ways and means to lend all people to a more humane and equitable station of life. Or you can forego the leadership role. But if you do, you must stand like a rock in support of those who do lead the way. It can be said in conclusion that when two forces meet and are placed in a position where neither can move, the situation requires either a confrontation or a compromise. The real challenge and the test of the 70s becomes a question that will extend into the 21st century. Will mankind rid itself of its evils of man's inhumanity to man, or will he perish in the fires of his inability to do so? I say that man will prevail, because young black brothers and young black sisters like you, and those whites who will enlist as true and honest soldiers in the Army of Liberation, you, my black brothers and sisters, and the few whites who are for real, will guarantee that man will indeed prevail, not as the oppressed and the oppressor, but as the total man, free to live life to the fullest as our Creator intended. Facing the rising sun of a new day begun, let us march on till victory is won. Thank you.
I'd like to remind all black students that following the question and answer period, discussions will be continued with Lou Palmer at the Culture Center. Okay, are there any questions? No questions?